Thanks for coming. You're in the transmission line session if you don't want to be here. I feel like on the plane, like, are you going to Detroit? You know, you should be someplace else. I'm not going to do a lot of introductions about our topic. It's in the book, and we'll have, I'm sure, lots of questions and lots of discussion afterwards. But certainly transmission lines, those ubiquitous corridors everywhere in our landscape, are about to become a lot more common. And to get green energy here, but there's a lot of issues surrounding it, from environmental cost, even some international issues. Congress is working on some plans to deal with transmission line siting. There's lots of hurdles around it. We'll hear a lot about that today. So let me start introducing everyone, and I'm going to start with Katie Nicola. Katie Nicola is an energy program director and staff attorney for Clean Wisconsin, a nonprofit environmental advocacy organization that was founded in 1970. Katie earned her master's degree and law degree from the University of Wisconsin in Madison, where we are. She's responsible for managing Clean Wisconsin's clean air and energy campaigns, including litigation, lobbying, grassroots organizing, and media. Katie grew up in northwestern Wisconsin, where there are still lakes and forests, and lives in Madison. Nina Plashin joined ITC Holdings Corporation as Director of Federal and Legislative Affairs in December 2008. For those of you who don't know or have heard of ITC, they're the largest independent transmission line company in the country. She's 20 years' experience in federal policy with a focus on utility, energy, and environmental issues. Her professional experiences include Vice President of External Affairs at Wisconsin Public Power, Director of Government and Regulatory Affairs at American Transmission Company, Manager of Federal Affairs at PP&L, Vice President of Hill & Knowlton, and Federal Consultant for Van Ness, Feldman & Curtis Law Firm. She's worked on every major energy bill in the past decade, beginning with the Energy Policy Act in 1992. She's testified before FERC, the Wisconsin Legislature, and local government boards, served as Legislative Director for Congressman C. Thomas McMillan, and worked on the staffs of many others. Senators. She graduated from Drew University, Madison, New Jersey, with a bachelor's degree in political science. And our last speaker will be Charlie Higley. He's executive director of the Citizens Utility Board of Wisconsin, a member-supported nonprofit organization that represents the interests of residential customers of electric, natural gas, and telecommunications utilities before regulatory agencies, the legislature, and the courts. Previously, he worked as program director for the Wisconsin Energy Conservation Corporation, where he managed the Focus of Energy program that provides energy efficiency and renewable energy services to residents and businesses in Wisconsin. Higley's worked as an energy research director and lobbyist for Public Citizen, a Washington, D.C.-based consumer advocacy organization that founded by, as we all know, Ralph Nader. He's a master's degree in business administration, a master's degree in urban and regional planning with a certificate in energy analysis and policy, all from the University of Wisconsin in Madison. He also has a physics degree. Let me lay out the ground rules here.
Well, not either.
Well, now you do. I'm going to ask them to each make statements, you know, somewhere between 5 and 7 minutes, and then we'll open up for questions. You guys should know the ground rules by now, but SEJ members first. Make the questions, you know, make sure you say who you are clearly and your affiliation, and ask questions and don't make long-winded statements, please. Those are really important. I'm really strict on that. So try to ask a question. Let's hear the answer and get a discussion going. Okay, we'll start with I'm actually going to start with Nina. Is that okay, Nina? You're on. Because people want to get the framework of this project going.
Okay. She's just mixing it up on me. As you heard in my introduction, I work for ITC Holdings, which we are the nation's largest independent transmission company. And what people don't understand what that means. What that means is that all we do is transmission, which is higher voltage power lines. We don't own any generation. We don't own any distribution, which is a bit of a departure. Normally, utilities are actually vertically integrated and own all three of those assets. So we only do transmission. We are headquartered out of Michigan. We have assets in Iowa, Minnesota, Illinois, Missouri, and we're developing in Kansas. We have about 15,000 miles of transmission under our control at this point. And we're the eighth largest transmission-owning utility in the nation, just to give you some idea of how we fit in with everyone else. We're talking about connecting renewables, which, of course, is something that ITC Holdings has been working on for about a year now, a lot longer, but publicly for about a year. We have announced and are in the process of developing what's called the Green Power Express, which is a six-state project 3,000 miles of 765 kV transmission to connect the wind in the Dakotas to load centers in the mid-Atlantic area. Goes across about six states, and it looks to move about 12,000 megawatts of wind energy. So we have a lot of experience in terms of what's going on with trying to connect renewables, what are the challenges, how does it differ from the way it used to be, and I think it's very useful when you talk about developing transmission to understand a little bit about how we traditionally have done transmission development. Transmission has always been sort of viewed as more of a local and at best regional resource. Really, you would build a power plant pretty close to where the people who used the power live. And then you would build a transmission line to connect it to the extent it was necessary. And sometimes, you know, it would just be a little bit of line, and then you'd build the distribution to get it into people's homes. That began to change in around the year 2000. Some federal legislation and some federal regulatory activities happened that created what we call wholesale markets, where people would buy and sell wholesale energy. And that began to change the way people started thinking about transmission, and they started thinking more about building more regional transmission to facilitate these markets. From ITC's perspective, we've had pretty limited results in getting regional transmission built. But now we have this new challenge, which is suddenly we're no longer really looking to build a system that's really predicated on the idea of building power plants close to demand or close to load. What we're looking at is connecting what are essentially remote resources and then moving that power to where the people are. And that's fundamentally different than the way we've done things to date. And it's different when you look at the three different key aspects of developing transmission. They're planning, it's siting, it's how you pay for it. Okay, and on the planning front, I've already elaborated a little bit about how it's different, but it's also different because we've really looked at planning transmission in an incremental fashion. We've looked at basically building the next small increment that you need to connect that power plant or to meet the reliability standard that you're trying to meet or to meet the transmission service request that has been placed. You're not looking forward too far in terms of anything other than making sure you meet reliability standards. You kind of, a power plant comes, they say, I want to get hooked up. You do a study, you do the whole analysis around that one power plant, you figure out how much it costs, then you do the next one. It's all sequential. And what ITC is proposing and what Green Power Express is really all about is to say, wait a minute, we know that there's a tremendous amount of wind resources that need to be connected, and we know where the wind is. And so why are we doing this in an incremental fashion when we think that that's probably less efficient, will end up being more expensive, and we probably won't get the right things built? And so what we're looking to do is, I mentioned 12,000 megawatts of wind. Well, the projections of how much wind can come out of the Dakotas is much higher than that. Okay, we're just looking to build like a small sliver of this. So I think one of the things I hear a lot of people say about our project is, well, you're building it and you're hoping people will come. It's the field of dreams. Okay, but what we like to point out is, you know, when we met with developers and we looked at what's in the line to be interconnected in terms of generation in the Midwest ISO, we calculated there was at least 23,000 megawatts of wind. The Midwest ISO, and for those of you who don't know what that is, that's sort of the regional body that controls all the transmission, including Wisconsin, okay, and Michigan, and 13 states. And essentially, Midwest ISO has said that in their line of generators waiting to be interconnected, there's 65,000 megawatts waiting to get online. Of that, 55,000 is wind. To give you just another example, last year, the capacity, the amount of wind that could be produced in this country, increased by half. And 40% of all of the new generation that came online was wind. So we don't think that we're building something that's so grandiose and big that it's not going to be utilized or that it's a field of dreams. We are very confident that 12,000 megawatts is a modest amount of power to look to move. But in order to do that, we can't get the kind of transmission we need. The higher voltage transmission is what we're looking to build, and the reason we're looking to build that is severalfold. First of all, it's more efficient. When you're moving power longer distances, you get more of the power that you create to the place it's used if you move it at a higher voltage. You have less what's called losses. Secondly, you use less land. It's not a one-for-one. People will hear about extra high voltage, and there's several different voltages. There's 345, there's 500 kV, and there's 765. And people will say, well, you go 345 or you go 765, you know, well, that's a little bit bigger. No, it's a lot bigger, okay? You can build the capacity that you can get on a 765 line is the equivalent of 6 345 lines. So you're using a lot less land space if you build a 765 versus 6 345 towers and corridors. So what we're trying to do is recognize that from a planning point of view, we need to look at things differently if we're going to try to move this large amount of resources to where they need to be used. We need to recognize that there's a tremendous amount of wind waiting to be connected to the grid that isn't happening. There have been projections that it will take the Midwest ISO, you know, something like 20 years to get through the backlog of generators who are waiting to be interconnected, including all that wind. And then on the siting point of view, I'm going to talk a little bit about that later when we get to, I'm going to briefly mention legislation because I was asked to. But right now, siting is also very state-focused. The states basically have the right to site what goes through their state. So when you're trying to build a transmission line that's going to go through six states, if any one state along that route basically says, well, we don't want to build it, the whole project is now no longer workable. So that's something that's a little different, too, when you're looking at building regional multi-state projects versus smaller, more localized projects. And then finally on the issue of cost, I think Charlie's going to primarily speak to that, but I would simply say that the cost allocation policies, how we decide who pays for what now, is completely a mess. You know, every region does it differently. Even within a given region, it's done differently based on what you're building the transmission for. Some people do it based on how high the voltage is. Some people do it based on whether if you're a generator interconnecting, you pay one way. If you're building for reliability, you pay another. If you're building because it's an economic project, you pay a third way. And if you're building because it's a transmission service request, it's a different way. So there's no predictability, and it's one of the reasons, I think a main reason why we're not seeing a lot of regional transmission built is because of the uncertainty and difficult nature of getting the cost recovery for this. Last point I want to make is on cost, because I know a lot of people hear about high voltage and they think, wow, that's really expensive, and is that really a good idea? Do we really need to have that much transmission and pay for that much transmission? I think it's important to put that in context. Transmission, on average, is 7 to 10%, that's a national average, of the overall cost of delivered power, the cost on your bill. So if, in fact, we build a transmission project, our project costs $10 to $12 billion. Is what the price tag is for our project right now. But if you built a bigger project that ended up raising that cost 20% more in terms of overall transmission cost, because of the percentage of the bill, that only translates into a 2% increase in rates. Okay? And when you look at our project, $10 to $12 billion, depending on how you spread those costs, if you spread it across just the entire, you know, Midwest ISO and the neighboring region called PJM, or you spread it across the entire interconnection, which is all of the area east of the Rockies, it's between 84 and 89 cents an average monthly bill. Why is that? It's because the way people pay for transmission is you don't pay for it all up front. You amortize it over the life of the project, which is basically 40 years. So you're paying for this over a very long period of time as the property depreciates. So I think it's important to recognize that transmission actually is probably, and not probably, is the least expensive component of the overall cost of delivered power. And in addition, you get savings, which we haven't even tried to calculate, in terms of lower generation costs because you get more efficient generation, lower cost generation, and you reduce losses, and you reduce congestion costs. So there's a variety of ways to look at this, and I think that just looking at the dollar numbers and going, wow, people are saying you're going to build $100 billion in transmission, or that's so much money. Well, it is, but at the same time, it's going to leverage a lot of savings, and if you spread it across a large area, it ends up being pretty insignificant. I would just close by mentioning federal legislation. ITC has been working very hard in Washington, which is actually where I'm based, to try to get some of the rules of how we deal with transmission, siting, planning, and cost allocation fixed, because we don't think they work very well right now. There is legislation that's pending before Congress. It's been passed by the full House of Representatives, and it has been passed out of committee in the Senate and is now pending, waiting for Senate action. Most of you are probably more familiar with other aspects of the bill which deal with climate change and also other kinds of energy issues, but there is a whole title on transmission that looks to basically address the issues I just mentioned.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Katie, you're up.
Okay.
Good transition.
Good morning.
Since I work for an environmental organization, I just want to start by saying that I'm really happy to have the opportunity to talk to environmental journalists, and I'm really happy to know that there are so many of you. So keep up the good work. Today I'd like to talk about transmission in the context of the need to clean up coal and to stop global warming, what we call our clean energy campaign. At Clean Wisconsin, our energy advocacy has broadened and I think become much more nuanced over just the last 5 years. When I started working at Clean Wisconsin in 2004, the organization was deeply involved in two high-profile cases, opposing the construction permit for a large coal-fired power plant on Lake Michigan and opposing the construction of a major high-voltage transmission line from Duluth, Minnesota, down to central Wisconsin called the Arrowhead Weston Transmission Line, which is actually now energized and operating. Both projects were highly controversial, and both generated an amazing level of citizen involvement across the state and a lot of really great activism. Clean Wisconsin was simultaneously challenging the state's approval of the coal plant at the Wisconsin Supreme Court and challenging the Department of Natural Resources' approval of wetlands permits that would allow the transmission line to cross through sensitive areas in northwestern Wisconsin. So Clean Wisconsin does the legal work, of course, but we also talk to journalists. We know how important it is that reporters communicate complex energy and environmental policy to the public and to decision makers. The press was particularly helpful last year when a well-informed public expressed their opposition to a proposed coal plant in southwestern Wisconsin down on the Mississippi, and that application was denied by the State Public Service Commission. So one of the commissioners, in making his decision to deny the application to build this coal plant, held up a huge binder full of public comments, which I think really were largely spurred by a lot of the media that we had gotten around this and the publicity about the health impacts of coal and, you know, just the environmental downside of it. So what about transmission lines? Clean Wisconsin hasn't opposed a transmission line proposal for 5 years, since the Arrowhead Weston line, although there have been many proposed and many have been built in that time period. A lot of local folks have contacted me with their concerns, saying, you know, telling me why they don't want the poles and wires running near their property, and I definitely understand their concerns. We look at the environmental impacts that come with transmission projects, and they are real and they can be significant. But we have had to prioritize. At the same time, we're looking at how installing large poles disturbs wetlands and forests. We're also aware that there are a lot of people living in the sooty shadow of coal plants who suffer respiratory problems from breathing fine particulate matter coming out of the stacks. We also know that the state DNR warns people not to eat fish from any of Wisconsin's many lakes and streams because they're all contaminated with mercury from coal-fired power plants, all of them. And we have all become aware that coal plant CO2 emissions are largely responsible for global warming. Prioritizing doesn't mean we'd never oppose another transmission project, but it does mean looking at them in a broader context. So is more transmission the solution to dirty coal? Will building more lines provide a pathway to bring green power to load centers? We believe that this will only happen if we take coal off the grid. We've worked hard in Wisconsin to enact a state renewable portfolio standard, the RPS, that requires that 10% of the electricity sold by utilities is renewable, and we're trying to get that percentage increased. Utilities are building big wind farms around the region. At the same time, carbon regulation is looming, as we all know, and there's a surplus of power available in Wisconsin because of all the coal plants we've built, because energy efficiency programs are working and are going to be increased, and to some extent, of course, because of the recession. From a reliability standpoint, we can well afford to retire some old coal plants which have reached the end of their natural, or I would say unnatural, lives. But because they're very profitable, utilities do not want to shut them down. In fact, they're asking state regulators right now for permission to spend billions of dollars to retrofit those old units with pollution controls to meet current air quality standards to keep them running for another 2 or 3 decades. Unfortunately, adding a scrubber doesn't eliminate a single ton out of the thousands of tons per year of CO2 that those boilers continue to emit. So you've heard about the need for more transmission lines that are dedicated to green power and the questions about whether those lines will be used to transfer coal power instead. One factor that I'd like to bring to your attention, which affects this equation, is the rules imposed on generators by the regional system operators. MISO, the Midwest System Operator, has rules that require coal plant owners to bid their power into the market at all times, a must-run rule. Coal plants don't easily ramp up and down with fluctuations in electric demand, so when demand is low, other types of generators are called upon to pull back, and wind is one of the easiest kinds of generation to pull back. You can adjust the blades, feather them, so they don't produce as much power on short notice. And so, when there are so-called minimum generation events and there's too much power on the system, the coal keeps running and the wind is knocked off. So what happens here is that in the name of reliability, renewables like hydro and wind are being taken offline simply because they're the easiest to ramp down. This obviously defeats the purpose of the RPS, and of course it increases air pollution and global warming emissions. MISO staff tells me that this is becoming more and more of a problem as more renewables come online and all the coal plants keep on running, and they've formed a committee to study the situation. From our perspective, the solution seems rather simple. Shut down the oldest, dirtiest coal plants to make room on transmission lines for clean, renewable energy. So I acknowledge we know that there may be a need for more transmission and distribution lines that will bring wind power to market, and we recognize that many technical, cost, and political factors need to be considered. But we think that the elephant in the living room is all the old coal that's being allowed to keep running while everyone discusses how much more transmission we need to build. We need a comprehensive regional plan that prioritizes getting clean, renewable energy online and retires unneeded, dirty coal. Thank you.
Thanks. And Charlie?
Good morning. My name is Charlie Higley, and I'm the executive director with the Wisconsin Citizens Utility Board. We're a ratepayer advocacy organization, sort of a utility watchdog organization. And as Beth mentioned, I also worked in D.C. for a while working on electricity policy back in the late 90s when a lot of the issues that Nina was talking about were kind of coming together. So my organization's chiefly worried about cost to consumers for electric power, natural gas, also telecom, but my specialty or the area I find most interesting is electric power. The in one way to try to keep costs under control is by doing a good job planning the system. So right now we have a big electric power system, and we're talking about making big changes to it. Katie was mentioning retiring some of our coal plants, and also building new renewables. Nina's talking about her company's interest in building new transmission lines to help move some of that power around. Well, how do you know what to build? How do you know where to put it? How do you know, how do you answer these questions, which do end up costing billions of dollars when you're actually answering them? Well, the way you do it is by doing planning. And traditionally, the electric power industry hasn't done a very good job of doing a planning. In fact, Wisconsin is kind of an example of a state that once had a very good planning process 10 years ago, but it was dismantled and done away with because 10 years ago there was a move toward deregulation in the electric power industry, and there thought that the market would take care of our needs. We wouldn't need to do planning. Wisconsin dismantled its process and now really doesn't have one. Most states don't. A lot of states got rid of their planning processes at that same time. So it's been very difficult for anybody to really answer these questions. Do we need more power plants and what kind? Do we need more power lines and where do we put them? But fortunately, and just recently, there's been a change in that. And it happened. It's happened very quickly, in my perspective, in the last few years. Now there are efforts, some of which are just getting underway, to try to answer these very questions. And I'll go through a few of the names of these planning processes, just because you may encounter them if you do studies on, if you do stories in this topic area. We've mentioned the term MISO, Midwest Independent Transmission System Operator. It's headquartered in Indiana, and it controls all the power plants and power lines in the Midwest, basically Ohio and West, and it includes 13 different states. Midwest ISO has a large role in now. It's a relatively new organization. It was only created about 10 years ago, and it's only really gotten its legs under it in the last five. It's now engaged in doing planning on a regional basis, working with companies like ITC, which own transmission, but also working with other companies. Many of the utilities in Wisconsin, well, they're all members of MISO. And so MISO is looking at the region as a whole and trying to figure out some of these questions. How do you plan for new transmission, given the desire to build new renewables, and then more recently even new coal plants? So that's a good development. The transmission system, the electric power system, is inherently a regional system. Pretty much all the power plants east of the Rocky Mountains are connected together. All the transmission lines east of the Rockies are connected together. You build one new line, it affects all the others. You build a new power plant, it has an impact on the way the whole system east of the Rockies operates. This is similar also for the western United States. Texas has its own grid, and then there's Quebec. They represent the four regional systems in North America. And so the only way you can really make any sense out of adding new generation or new power plants is by doing regional planning. Well, the United States, the states don't work together well doing things together. So it's really good to see these efforts coming up, and one of them is MISO. Another one was an organization Nina mentioned called PJM. They run the transmission system for Pennsylvania, Maryland, and New Jersey. That's where the name came from, but also other states as well. And there are other similar organizations doing planning now, trying to look at those needs. More specifically to the Midwest, our state regulators and governors realize that to try to answer this question of how do we move the renewable energy that's available in the wind from the Great Plains, how do we deal with that? How do we build it up? And how do we move it to the population centers? So they created an effort called the Upper Midwest Transmission Development Initiative. UMTDI.
The acronym for that.
UMTDI. So this is involving the states of Wisconsin, North Dakota, South Dakota, Iowa, and Minnesota. They hope to be wrapping up their work in the next 6 months, and they're looking at how do we move this wind power from the Midwest to the population centers, how much would it cost, and how do we get everybody to pay for it, all right? So that's an important initiative, and I think its work is hopefully going to be completed, I think, in the next 6 months, maybe even more soon than that. And as a result of the stimulus legislation passed last February in Washington, there are two efforts going on to try to look at the entire eastern system of the electric power industry. The eastern system is called the Eastern Interconnection. It underlines how all these facilities are actually linked together. So money is now available for two efforts: Eastern Interconnection Planning Collaborative, and that is largely an effort by the electric power industry itself to do planning on over the entire Eastern Interconnection. That never has been done before. And then the state governments are getting involved in their own effort, and it will be running alongside this first one. The state government effort is called the Eastern Interconnection State's Planning Council, ICEPIC, is the acronym for that. The first one was IPIC. Is that
so
what it's being called?
There's going to be a test afterwards.
Yeah. I'm going ahead and trying to be slow with the names of these, but if you have questions about it, let me know, because, I mean, this is kind of the new thing in electric power is people are finally planning. That's really, really a good deal. So ICEPIC is the state government attempt, and maybe it must have been one of the first times. The Eastern Interconnection, I think, covers about 39 states and the District of Columbia, and I think 35 of those entities got together to talk about planning. And that may have been one of the first times that many states have been together in the same room talking about a topic of how do we do things together. There are regional compacts in the United States that try to handle regional issues, but I don't know, this might have been one of the biggest attempts at seeing states get together to try to look at a single issue. So extraordinary, really. If it can hold together, that'd be even more extraordinary. Those are efforts going on. And there's another one that just was announced by the American Transmission Company. They own the transmission lines here in Wisconsin. ATC, also involved with other utilities, are looking at a transmission study. Again, it's to look at how do we move renewable energy in the Midwest to Chicago, Ohio, the areas where all the people live. That's called the SMART transmission study. I'm not sure what the acronym stands for, but that's another one to look at. Yeah. Not even 5 years ago, there were none of these. Well, there were some beginnings of these collaboratives, but now we're seeing far more interest in looking at the system and trying to figure out how do we put it together in the right way. And so that's a good development, and I have great hope that these studies will provide benefit. Now, I will be a little critical in one aspect, though. Traditionally, and this is true for many different parts of American society, but especially true for the electric power industry, it's a complicated industry, and therefore the companies that are involved with it dominate the industry. They dominate the legal aspects. They dominate the lobbying. They dominate the planning. As a consumer advocate, I've often stressed the need for having the public more involved in these efforts. I'm glad that the state governments are getting involved in planning through this ICEPIC initiative. That's a very good development. But we do need to make it these processes more available to people in general. And it's very difficult to do because attending all these planning meetings takes a lot of time and a lot of expertise. And how do you pay for that? Well, organizations like mine have always had a hard time trying to keep up with these developments for those very reasons, staff, costs, and expertise. But it's essential that the consumers of the power be involved in these processes because we're ultimately the ones who need this stuff, right? Sure, it's great that the industry gets involved in planning, but they're the ones selling us the stuff. It's really important for people on the other side who use it to be involved in these processes. That's not going to be easy, a challenge to address. I had one more final point to make, but I forgot it, so I'll stop there, and then we can go on to some questions.
Thanks, all of you. That was really informative. I'm going to start off with some questions, and then people just raise their hand, and we'll get going from there. But I'm just curious, what is a 765 voltage line? What does it look like? I mean, I think most of us are familiar with what transmission line corridors look like, but describe it, the diameter.
It looks exactly like the 345 lines you see around anywhere else. It's just got taller towers. It's bigger.
And the other question I had, you know, in New England, there's a lot of concern, since I'm from New England, that a letter went out to, I think, Midwest ISO. I can't remember who. Or FERC, maybe.
It went to Congress.
Oh, went to Congress. Concerned that an effort to really draw on renewables from North Dakota to feed into the grid is really going to really impact New England's efforts and the Northeast effort to build offshore wind. Could you address that?
I'm sure that...
Right. Yeah. It's all about jobs,
yeah.
Right, at the
yeah.
end.
Yeah. I'm sure Katie would probably want to comment on this, too, but I would just say that, you know, again, I like to put things in context a little bit because I think, unfortunately, what started out as people beginning to all come together and say, yeah, we need to do something about actually accessing all these renewables who are just basically sitting around idle because we can't connect them to the grid, has now turned into sort of this debate about an either-or. Well, I want to build my wind, so you shouldn't build your wind. And the fact is, right now, what are we at, like 1% in this country in terms of renewable use? We're talking about mandates that are 15, 20% nationally. We need a lot of wind. We need a lot of solar. We need biomass. We need everything. So I don't, and I know ITC doesn't view it as an either-or equation. But I would say, and this would probably be something Charlie, I think, would support, at the end of the day when we talk about renewables and connecting them, you know, we do need to be conscious of cost. And not all renewables are created equal. Different renewables have different what we call capacity factors, which means the price per megawatt hour is either higher or lower based on the amount of wind you can produce, how often the wind is blowing, basically, okay? 30% isn't as good as 42%, okay? So the best wind, some of the best wind is either offshore or in the Dakotas. When you start developing in Wisconsin, it's very nice, but the capacity factors are not as high, okay? In addition, I'm not aware of any wind that you're going to connect where you don't have to build transmission. And I think one of the myths or misconceptions that's come out of this debate in New England is that if you build wind in New England, you won't need any transmission. Well, that's fundamentally not true. In fact, the New England ISO, who's their sort of regional power transmission organization, put out a report a couple weeks ago that basically said, yeah, we need to build a lot of transmission because our grid, you have to understand, most of the transmission in this country is 30 to 50 years old. It's stressed. It's old. We have poles, wood poles, that are 60 years old out there with woodpecker holes up and down. I mean, there's a lot of work that needs to be done to the transmission system. It's been fundamentally lagged in terms of investment. You know, integrated utilities who own both generation and transmission found it more profitable and better to put their money into generation. It prevents competition if you don't have more transmission. There's just a lot of reasons why we've been skewed towards generation solutions and not towards transmission. And so we have a system that's got a lot of congestion on it. It's got a lot of old systems that need to be replaced, and it doesn't go where it needs to go. So while I appreciate that, you know, we want to build offshore wind in New England, I think that's great. But, you know, you're going to spend a lot of money to build transmission to connect offshore wind. The underwater lines are exponentially more expensive than above ground lines. So it's not mile for mile. Like, if I build a bigger line to the Dakotas, that will be much more expensive than a shorter line out 20 miles out to sea. I don't know whether that's true or not. You'd need to do a delivered cost test to figure out which one was better when you weigh in the capacity factors and all the other costs associated with developing those plants. So I think that at the end of the day, we'd like to see them all developed. We think there's plenty of demand for it, and we think that there's plenty of opportunity. If we do what Katie's talking about, which is replacing baseload coal, we're going to need even more resources. So I think all of that works. And I guess the one last comment I would make is, which I failed to make earlier when we were in the planning conversation, reminded me of this. When we're talking about, you know, these remote resources where wind is, those are some of the smallest systems in the country in terms of transmission. North Dakota has a peak load, which means the most energy it ever uses at any time, 3,000 megawatts. We want to move 12,000 new megawatts of power over that system. So that's one of the reasons why we're talking about, well, we need to build up all this transmission. And the way that transmission is paid for today, the Dakota people would basically pay for a huge amount of that, even though they wouldn't be using even a third of that power. That's why we think the rules need to be changed.
But do you want to talk about that?
Actually, I agree with Nina.
Shocking.
Say who you are.
Oh, sorry, Chad Brown with Discovery Channel. How do you convince people in New England that are believing that all the jobs are going to North Dakota to build wind turbines?
Well, I think, I'm a lobbyist, and I spend a lot of time meeting with members of the New England delegation to try to explain to them why they shouldn't be opposing trying to do some reforms. And, you know, there's a couple things going on here. First of all, what we are seeing are some of the states, not Massachusetts, but Maine, and some of the other states who want to develop wind, recognizing that if they actually develop the wind resources they have, they can't use it all. They don't have enough load. They don't have enough demand, so they're going to have to move their power and export it out. And suddenly now they're talking about building a transmission, spending a lot of money, Does New Hampshire want to pay for all that transmission itself? Does Maine? Hell no. I mean, they want to figure out a way to get that transmission built too. So I think, first of all, people are beginning to recognize that there's a need to deal with export issues no matter where you develop it. Because when you build, if you build in a really good capacity area, you're going to build a big enough farm that you're not going to use it all where you drop it off, okay? Secondly, people are also beginning to realize that you get the ability to develop more resources if you have an interconnected transmission grid that allows you to balance the different wind resources. The wind might not be blowing in Massachusetts right now, but maybe it's blowing in North Dakota. And because we have an interconnected grid, that actually lets them build more resources and create more jobs. And then, you know, finally, I would just say a large part of the job creation that comes out of renewable energy is not necessarily from where the facility is placed. It's from building the components. We're headquartered in Michigan. We're looking at building lots of components for solar in the state of Michigan. That's where the real money is. It's in developing the pieces of the equipment and the components for the turbines and all these other things. Well, I did see, now, am I allowed to say something that no one will put on the record if it's funny? No. Come on. I won't say it then. Forget it. You can ask me in the hall and I'll tell you. But anyway, but I will say that I think some of the job estimates I've seen coming out of New England might be slightly inflated. You know, I think that there's some job creation that comes, but there's also job creation that comes from building transmission, too. And transmission jobs stick around for a long time because you've got to maintain the lines. Well, as I said earlier, the higher voltage you have, the lower losses you have. So by building a 765, you're going to get a lot more ultimate power delivered to your endpoints than you would. And I say points, not point. I think sometimes people think of transmission as being an extension cord. You'll hear people say that. There are certain kinds of transmission that operate like an extension cord, but not the kind of transmission we're talking about. If you're talking about alternating current AC transmission, it's an integrated network. The power flows in both directions. It has multiple on and off ramps, okay? But there's less losses associated with that. There are, obviously, you mentioned the superconductor technologies. People are looking at that, which for those of you who aren't in the business, all that means is the stuff that's inside the line, the metal they use, when you put power across it, it gets hot. You can only put so much power across it because the line starts to melt, okay? And if it starts to melt, it sags, and then you have this cascading failure, and it's a debacle. So essentially, we look at different kinds of conductor technologies to try to figure out a way to get better heat resistance so that the lines stay up longer and you can put more power over them. There's a lot of things going on that are pretty interesting and exciting, but in terms of actual commercial feasibility right now, not much. American Superconductor has a technology that they've been talking about that is an underground technology that, you know, a lot of people are excited about. There's some provisions in the legislation on that. At this point, you know, it would require significant amounts of liquid nitrogen to keep those lines cool, and we don't really understand from an environmental point of view how that would work. So we're not prepared to do that kind of technology, but I do know, in fact, if you look around at some of the ATC lines, which I used to work there, so I know a little bit about them, you'll see that some of the lines are actually spiral. Has anybody noticed that some of the lines look like they're coiled around? That's actually, they reconfigured the lines so that they could get better capacity factors out of them instead of just having the straight line. So there have been some developments that are in practical use, but no major breakthroughs that I know of.
Sure. I think that the approach that we take at Clean Wisconsin is that while we might generally support a particular technology like wind or anything really, or a particular initiative, we always want to look at the particular environmental impacts of that project. So a good example of that is there was a recent proposal to build a biomass plant in northern Wisconsin. And, of course, biomass is considered renewable. But we wanted to look at the details of that and check into whether they were considering forest sustainability and a bunch of other factors. And so I feel the same way about transmission projects. If there's a better route that you could take them through, then why not do it? I mean, I understand there's cost factors to be considered, but our job is to advocate for making sure that the environment is protected. And so so we at least would intervene and advocate for perhaps changing the route or changing the construction methods or a number of things that would be more protective. Well, that's a hard question. I don't think that there are hard and fast guidelines. I think it's always a balancing act when you look at these projects. I mean, you always have to look at the benefits versus the detriments of any project. And so if it's, you know, is it 2 miles of wetland? How is it high quality wetlands? Is it, you know, I mean, so I think that there are just always a lot of things to consider, and that's what we try to do.
Are you asking me that as a developer? We would probably at all costs avoid it because it adds at least a year in terms of regulatory process. We'll have to go through the Forest Bureau. We have to go to the federal government. They won't even look at the application until the state approves it. And then we have to do mitigation measures. So the only time we would ever do it is because there's no other way. You know, you'd either have to go so far out of your way that it would exponentially increase the cost of the project, or, you know, there's just no other way. I mean, you know, there are places in Wisconsin where you just have to cross a wild and scenic river. I mean, you know, or you have to cross a wetland. There's just no way around it. So,
Can you say who you are?
Oh, John Addison, Clean Creek Report.
Okay, great. And then,
The question was about the fact that federal legislation is looking at creating a national renewable requirement in the, you know, somewhere between 15% and 20% are the numbers that are being looked at. Certainly in the states, we even see people talking about 25% renewables. Is that realistic, particularly given the transmission constraints that I've alluded to? I think the answer is that I spend probably 60% of my time working with wind advocates. And the reason that they hang out with me is because they're well aware of the fact that if we don't build the transmission, we're not going to get these renewables to market. And we're not going to be able to meet these thresholds. And the other thing that we've been talking to elected officials about are the climate change goals. You know, we've got some targets and timetables in the climate change legislation looking at 2020. Well, I should have started building that power line, you know, 3 years ago. Okay, so one of the reasons why we're pushing so hard, you might have seen our ad in your brochure here, that we're pushing for legislation is we can't wait another 5 years to modify the rules for transmission. We need to do it now. Charlie's talking about planning. Yeah, we need to plan it now. We need to start siting it. It could take 10 years to build these facilities. So we have to get on it now. But ITC doesn't take a position on what's a more realistic goal. We think we should be trying to do that. We think that a federal RPS would be useful from a planning point of view because right now we don't know what we're shooting for. When we planned the Green Power Express, we went to every state in the Midwest ISO region and figured out what their state renewable requirement was, and that's what we planned to. But it would be nice if it didn't keep changing every year. So when you're building assets that are going to be in use for at minimum 40 years, it would be nice that you planned it right the first time. And that's one of the reasons why we think a federal RES would be useful, because at a minimum, at least then we'd know what to target, what we're building for, what we're trying to reach. And the same thing would go with climate change. But I would say that there are going to be challenges to connecting renewables, and it is one of the reasons why we looked at the Green Power Express. When ITC acquired its transmission in Iowa, we own only a portion of the assets in Iowa, but there are a big chunk of them. The first day we got into Iowa, the wind people were there saying, I want to get online, I want to get online. We have been going breakneck speed. We have connected more wind than anyone else in the country, okay? And we can't keep up. And we can't do it because of the process and the way it works right now, which is why we're talking about something like the Green Power Express, which is a much bigger project, which is sort of looking holistically at all of the development that's in the line, in the queue, as we call it right now, and building a project to meet everybody's need at the same time, instead of trying to do it piecemeal.
Can I add a follow-on? The other part of the equation is, all right, so we have the idea, let's say 20% renewable electricity by 2020, right? So that's saying of all the electricity we use, 20% of that needs to be from renewables. Well, one of the things we advocate for is energy efficiency, right? So if you make your homes and businesses more efficient, you don't need as much power. Therefore, you wouldn't need as much renewable power either to make up that 20%. Okay, so this is important because efficiency, people realize it's an important thing, but it often doesn't get the attention it needs. The federal energy legislation is including provisions for efficiency, but not sufficient, in my opinion. And hopefully they'll get strengthened as the Congress continues working on this. But that said, along with renewable energy goals, many states also have or are developing goals for energy efficiency. And the thought is that if we were aggressive, we could save about 2% of our electric use per year, about the same for natural gas use. Well, that happens to be about the rate at which electricity and gas use has grown. So if we were successful in energy efficiency efforts, then we could basically levelize our demand for electricity going forward. Historically, it's been growing. Our use of electricity grows every year. But if we did effective energy efficiency programs, and Wisconsin is one of the states leading the way on that, we can maybe hopefully levelize our demand for electricity going forward. And that means we need ultimately fewer renewables to meet those goals, fewer transmission lines, fewer power plants. So it's the real most important policy is stronger energy efficiency programs. It helps us achieve all these other goals while minimizing impacts on the environment, saving consumers money. It's the most important part of this energy equation, and hopefully it will be factored into these planning efforts.
Okay, we're gonna start
over here,
and then we're gonna work our way around this clockwise. Okay.
Yep.
You. Well, the transmission title is different in the House and the Senate bill. I'm going to focus on the Senate bill primarily because it's a much more comprehensive title. The House bill has some pretty minimal things dealing with planning, and then it has sort of a very strange section on siting. The Senate bill, I think, is more reflective of sort of what people are looking at in terms of reform, so I'm going to focus on the Senate bill. On the planning side, it talks about what we call interconnection-wide planning, and this is what Charlie was talking so much about. Right now, the way we do planning on the east side of the Rockies is we have 43 separate planning entities who plan. And I like to make the analogy of if you were building a house and you had 8 rooms in that house and you had 8 architects help you build it, every room would be beautiful. It just might not be a very good house. And that's basically what we have going on with the transmission grid. We have a very balkanized, bifurcated process. And so what we're looking at, what the federal government's trying to do, what a lot of states are trying to do, everyone's starting to suddenly go, well, you know, when we were just building that little piece of line to connect the power plant that was kind of in our state, this was fine. But now that I got to go across 6 states, this doesn't work anymore. So planning. So it essentially says that we're going to roll up all of the local planning that's going on in those 43 entities and then the separate entities in the Western Interconnection. We're going to then take all the regional plans and we're going to put those all together into an interconnection-wide plan. And the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission is going to have authority to sort of look at that and make sure it's consistent with the policy objectives in the bill as well as in terms of the projects that are in there. That's probably the most controversial piece because some people don't feel that the federal government should have any say in what the plan says. On siting,
Right now, in 05, Congress passed legislation that gave the federal government so-called backstop siting authority, which meant if a state was unable to act or failed to act within a year or rejected an application or overly conditioned an application for any transmission that was in a congestion corridor, the federal government was allowed to be, you could appeal to the federal government and they could choose to step in. They didn't have to, but they could choose to review the application. There was a recent court decision called the Piedmont decision, which basically gutted that entire statute. And now as long as the state does something, there is no backstop siting authority. The legislation looks at basically reinstating what the 05 Act did, exact same provision, if within a year, et cetera, et cetera. And then the last issue is cost allocation, which basically Congress isn't trying to rate make. What they basically say is for what we call, what they're calling national priority transmission lines, regional extra high voltage lines, FERC is going to have to, FERC, Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, who regulates wholesale transmission, is going to have to do a rulemaking and figure out how to pay for these lines and what's fair. But in that context, they have to make sure that no region is disproportionately burdened with costs versus benefits that they receive. And they can have the option of spreading those costs broadly across a region or subregion, or they can directly assign them to the generator. It's pretty much an open field, so it'll be a complete melee if it happens. You know, we'll have to go over and deal with the regulatory side. There is a whole section in the bill dealing with federal lands and how transmission is sited on federal lands, because that's a separate regulatory process through the federal government. And there is an attempt to deal with corridors and who takes the lead in terms of dealing with those permitting processes in the federal government. Up until now, DOE under the 05 Act, Energy Policy Act of 05, had authority to coordinate all the federal agencies. There's been a big push to move that over the Department of Interior. And I'm sure the environmentalists can speak more to that, but there's, I think, a feeling among some people that the Department of Interior would be more perhaps protective of federal lands and environmental issues than Department of Energy has been. And then there is an entire portion of the bill that deals with removing the existing congestion corridors, because nobody thinks those really work. And there's a whole debate going on about how do you either give preference to renewable resources, green resources on these lines, or even prevent traditional fossil generation from using lines so that we're not, you know, just facilitating more coal-fired generation.
Do you guys want to add, or can I go? Okay. Who's next?
Yeah, the Wisconsin and a couple other states, California, have been leaders in energy efficiency, and there's several approaches. Most of our programs offer rebates or cashback rewards. If you make your home or business more efficient, you'll get some money back when you buy the efficient appliance to, or add insulation, things like that. But making the products more efficient is very important. I think the computer manufacturers finally are waking up to the fact that they can make their, and the television manufacturers, they can make their products use far less power when they're not on, right? That's just an example. And so there are primarily federal standards that relate to the efficiency of equipment, and those are being strengthened over time. Probably the hardest part to get at, though, is the existing buildings, existing homes, existing commercial buildings are where all the efficiency lies, right? They're the buildings, you know, buildings last 100 years, and so most of our building stock is 100 years old. And so how do you get to that? That's the real challenge. It's called retrofits in the energy efficiency world. Part of the stimulus package has money available for encouraging retrofit programs, and that's going to be the real nut to bust. But it does help when you make building codes for new buildings, tighten those up, make build new buildings better, appliance standards, make sure that things made, people buy, those are efficient. Going after the existing building, that's the hard part, but that's the important part for efficiency.
I'd like to just add, too, that there's a push to identify sort of behavioral things that are going to resonate with people so that they change their behavior. And that kind of goes to conservation, I guess, more than efficient products or building codes. But there's a lot of bang for the buck that you can get from just conservation and changing your behavior.
Oh, no, not you. Sorry.
you already had a question.
People, yeah, I go back to people's questions. So it's going to be her, Kim, and Chad, and you.
First of all, I would just point out again that I own no generation, operate no generation, make no money off of the sale of power, only transmission. What you've just touched on is the whole decoupling debate, which, of course, is going on in Wisconsin, has been going on nationally, is actually in the legislation I mentioned, in the efficiency title of the legislation. And, you know, it's an interesting dilemma because, of course, generators, traditional utilities, make money based on selling more power. So why would they have any incentive to do conservation programs so they can make less money? And so the idea has been brought up that you should decouple those two things so that they would then have an incentive to save. However, the devil's in the details. You know, how do you make it so that they don't just make money no matter what the hell happens? You know, I mean, to be frank, you know, I mean, I can say these things because I'm not a marketer. But, I mean, that's basically what it is. And how do you factor in variables like weather and all these other things? How is it fair? And people have really been wrestling with this, and I'm sure others can speak to it more than I can. But I would just say that I certainly think that people are aware of this problem. I will say that the downturn in the economy has resulted in a tremendous amount of drop in load. People aren't using as much power as they used to use, and people are getting very surprised by this because it's resulting in a lot of people coming in for more rate cases to ask for more money. Because, of course, you have an embedded cost. What it cost you to build your power plant cost X amount. And when you don't have as much people paying for it because they foreclosed on their home or they just don't pay their bill, they can't make enough money to get their embedded costs back. And so now people are coming in saying, I need to raise my rates. Yeah. So that's part of what's going on.
That's
so
somewhat yeah. The power companies, and I understand that you're not a yeah. Have an interest in making sure their shareholders are happy.
That's true, too.
I'm in the middle of a place where our transmission costs have just been increased by 24 or 35%. Right. Or that's the request. I don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
And that's part of, they'll tell you, they want more money for their shareholders so that then they can make better investments. And I don't think that's quite really what's going on.
I think it also bears noting that CEOs of utilities typically make million-dollar salaries. So another thing to consider, they could perhaps scale back.
Tim Wheeler with the Baltimore Sun. We've got a couple of projects in our region, and it's, you know, there's been quite a tremendous amount of pushback on that. One of the issues that's come up has been in the MAP project, Mid-Atlantic Power Project in particular, which already runs under the Chesapeake Bay. It's built. Folks want to see it underground or underwater all the way through its connection. Can you talk a bit about the cost factors there? I'm going to really get a decent answer out of the market.
Well, the general rule of thumb is I can't give you a direct answer about what the different cost is between undergrounding and above ground because there's a number of variables. What's the voltage? What kind of terrain are we talking about? Is it underwater or is it under land? Yeah, I mean, there's just a lot of factors, so it's not fair to just give it. But I can give you a ballpark number, which is about 10 times more expensive.
Okay.
So, yeah, about 10 times more expensive. And that is not underwater. That's just regular land, okay? Underwater is even more expensive. And I'm sure the environmentalists love that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're talking about the PATH project. Is that the one you're talking about? Yeah. Oh, okay. Okay, yeah. I guess the one thing I want to mention about undergrounding, because I think it's important to get this out there, which is you know, anything that is a high voltage line, a 345 line, for example, you can put that underwater, okay? And chances are, if it's underwater, it's not going to even be an AC line. It might be a DC line. But you can put it underwater because you can keep it cool. If you start putting that underground, just like they're talking about right now in Madison here, there's a big debate. Charlie can tell you about that. You know, they can only do it for part of the line because it just makes the efficiency of the line drop so much. It gets so hot, you have so much resistance, you lose all the benefit of having the higher voltage. Why would you do it? Okay? And when you get to 500, 765, it doesn't go underground. They don't do it. Okay? So you can't keep the equipment cool enough. That's why I was mentioning that superconductor technology they're looking at that would let us put it underground. You have to put it in a vat of liquid nitrogen or something to keep it cool. That's how they keep it cool. So there are limitations from a physical point of view. I know it sounds very desirable to say put it underground, but there's actually technical limitations to it. Well, there's a couple of different proposals that have been put out there. It is impossible and he has a degree in physics, so I should let him respond to this. But because it's an integrated network, power flow is on the path of least resistance. It goes wherever it wants. So you don't actually control the electrons on any given line, okay? That's the first premise. In addition, because you have to keep everything in constant balance, you know, you sometimes have, as Katie pointed out, you know, you pull up a plant, you pull down a plant. There's a lot of stuff going on minute by minute, second by second, okay? So I get a little nervous when people try to talk about dedicating a line because it's not really going to be dedicated. What we're talking about is who gets to interconnect to it, who gets to hook up to it, okay? And when you do that for a renewable and intermittent resource, it's not going to run all the time. You're going to have what we call balancing. There's going to have to be some other resource on that line. If it's farther away wind that has a different topography, so it blows at a different time, maybe it's storage, it's a battery, it's pump storage, so that at the right time you let the water go down the dam and you create electricity when you need it, or maybe it's natural gas, but there has to be something else on that line to help with the balancing. But I do think that there are ways, if people want to certainly favor renewable resources. They can get priority in terms of the queue placement. They can get certain kinds of capacity rights to the line. They can, you know, have, you know, a open season where they get to, you know, get on first. I mean, there's different ways you can do it, but I just, my engineers would kill me if I got quoted somewhere saying that, you know, we can dedicate a line because it's not actually physically possible. But in terms of how you structure the regulations, one thing people have been looking at is that maybe only lines that have a certain percentage of renewables get the favorable regulatory treatment. And if you put coal on it, well, that's great. You can build it, but you got to use the old process. So, I mean, there's a couple different ideas that are out there.
Chad, did you?
Just really quickly, Chad again from Discovery Panel. TV Pickens made a lot of news recently, and I'm just curious on getting the panel's take on. He's, particularly when it comes to the economy, he was there trying to build the largest wind farm anywhere, and in the end, he couldn't because of transmission lines. Texas wasn't going to provide what he needed to get it out. And so he's going elsewhere. He's looking elsewhere now. But, I mean, is there enough incentive to build these farms if the transmission lines aren't going to? If someone like him with his own...
Well, yeah, in name of full disclosure, we work with T. Boone Pickens' subsidiary Mesa in Washington. We're part of a lobbying coalition with them, so I am somewhat familiar with his situation. T. Boone Pickens has a large number of turbines that he's going to have to put in a warehouse somewhere, so my guess is he has a really strong incentive to build a wind farm somewhere, or else he's got to sell them. But I actually think there's a huge incentive for wind. I already told the numbers. I mean, 40% of all the generation that was interconnected, you know, last year was wind. So clearly people want it. There are renewable portfolio requirements that are driving it. People recognize there's risk associated with carbon-based generation, and so they're not necessarily rushing out there to build those plants. They're going, I'm going to build a wind plant. I know I can run it. The beauty about wind, or even solar for that matter, is you've got the upfront cost of building the facility, but then there's no fuel charge.
So you have like a flat levelized rate as far as the eye can see. You don't have to worry about the price of coal going up. You don't have to worry about whether natural gas spikes. I mean, from a utility point of view, it's actually a very desirable kind of economics there. You've also got all sorts of incentives. We've got the production tax credit on the federal level. You've got other kinds of incentives. So, and even states now, you've seen Michigan, other states are trying to incentivize doing it. So I think everyone wants to accomplish the same thing. I think the problem is that, as I said, all the rules that govern how we do transmission were not developed with this in mind. And now there's a lot of people who have a lot vested, whether it's state regulators or local regulators or others, in sort of the status quo, and it's just hard to change that because people are worried. They don't want people to build too much transmission. They don't want people to build the wrong transmission. They don't want to pay for something they don't benefit from, which are all legitimate things, but it's resulted in a logjam, and we basically, I don't think, there's plenty of wind farms going up and people are building them, but we are getting close, in ITC's territory at least, to what we call the envelope, which is we can't do anymore.
Well, let me actually, there's two questions I want to get through, so Alan and then Peter.
Alan Best, a freelancer working in this case for Planning Magazine. My question has to do with...
Alan, before you ask, we have to do this quickly because I've been ordered. We have to stop at noon, so that's 4 minutes. So, okay.
The question has to do with the case out of Minnesota, where they are not feel like they are not getting any part of this transmission line. If I understand this very correctly, the same thing can be said for a transmission line that goes from Wyoming to California across to Nevada. As you look forward into this, how do you balance both the regional, national, and then local needs so that there's a state for them too?
Well, it's just that's the real challenge for us. In the United States, there's no easy way for states to work together on addressing regional issues. So, the attempt is then for states to voluntarily get together and try to address planning. Now, federal legislation could help that process along as well, if it's properly designed. But it's a good challenge.
Mm-hmm. I guess I would just say that, and I'll make it clear. No. I would just say that I think there needs to be a bigger federal role. That's the bottom line. I mean, we never would have built the interstate highway system if we let the states try to work it out. Okay? So, you know, I mean, the bottom line is I think that people have legitimate concerns. I think there's a regulatory process in place where people shouldn't pay for transmission that they don't get any benefit from. But there's an awful lot of, oh, we don't benefit from that, and yet it creates all kinds of reliability benefits. You know, just a quick example, when we build a 765 in Iowa that we want to build, it acts like a vacuum cleaner. It pulls all the power up from the lower voltages. There's 150 projects we eliminate. We don't have to build in Iowa now on the lower voltages. That happens all over the country when you build a backbone for the system. So it's not that easy to just go, it doesn't go through my backyard, so it doesn't benefit me. It's all interconnected. It's a spider web. It's not an extension cord.
And Peter, did you...
That's already happening here. I mean, they might do that in Madison. So, yes, that's happening. Yeah. I would just be clear about this from a development point of view. As a transmission developer, if you build a more expensive project, I make more money. Okay? So if it's possible to put this stuff underground and you want to pay for it, we're happy to do that. I think the problem is when projects end up costing 10 times what you thought they were going to cost, no one wants to build them because they say they're too expensive. So it's a balancing act between those two things. I would say that I do think to the extent there's also it's not just a cost issue. There's also a reliability and service issue. If a 345 that you've got partially underground goes bad, you don't know where the error and the fault is in that line. You got to dig it up. It takes a long time. People are offline for 2 weeks. They aren't happy. So that would be my only comment. Yeah. Well, direct current lines are useful in certain situations. It basically means the power moves in one direction. That is an extension cord. That goes from a power plant to a sink, and that's it. Nobody else benefits. No on, no off ramps, okay? DC lines, I think, you know, you see those primarily, particularly like offshore wind. I think DC would be a relevant technology. You do see some proposals for moving renewables on DC lines. ITC does not think DC lines are the right way to go because we believe that you should build transmission given the opposition to transmission, the land concerns, the environmental concerns. If you're going to build a line, let's build a line that does a whole bunch of things. Because if I build a DC line, it doesn't improve reliability. It doesn't take congestion off the grid. It doesn't allow economic transactions. It doesn't do anything for anybody except for the person at the end of the line. And I just don't think politically that's viable.
We got to close.